Pod Culture, episode 298, TARDIS Interruptus, volume 14, The Doctor is In Again, for Monday, December 5th, 2011.
Hello, this is Sylvester McCoy, the 7th Doctor Who. You're listening to Pod Culture, TARDIS Interruptus.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Pod Culture TARDIS Interruptus, the Parsec award-winning podcast. Yeah. Almost stumbled over that. Still kind of hard to say, you know?
I know.
Yeah. All right.
It's too awesome to say.
It yeah.
But we have another audio treat. You know, the last time we had a TARDIS Interruptus that you guys may have heard just a little bit ago, we had some audio from Sylvester McCoy, panel at DragonCon, which, awesome. You guys ever get a chance to see him at a convention?
Go. You will not be sorry. He's so entertaining.
Yeah. And, I'm Brad.
I'm Christina.
I'm Adam.
I'm Justin.
And I'm Richard.
Yeah, I almost forgot that, you know? Got the whole...
We got excited.
Yeah. Because it's freaking the Doctor,
it
man.
Is the Doctor.
Yeah, I just played the clip for everybody. Someone had put it up on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
It was in, I believe it was our last... The Friday from audio from the Friday panel.
Yes.
Sylvester McCoy's reading of Matt Smith's monologue thing
from
Pandorica opens.
Yeah, his
awesome. Stonehenge.
Hello, Stonehenge monologue.
That's it. Hello, Stonehenge.
I'm so going to do that.
I can only imagine what that would be like on screen.
Oh,
for him.
I weep.
With him.
He would need help getting up because he's not that tall.
Anybody help me up off this big stone?
Oh, I'm not saying I'm not saying I could do it either, but I'm just saying he would need to use his little umbrella to get him up there.
Yeah. He's like my size.
Yeah, he's really not that tall.
Yeah, but he was awesome, and I hope you guys enjoy this panel. I believe this was Saturday's.
I didn't hear this one, so I'm excited to hear it too.
Yeah, there were a few different stories. Some of the stories you might hear might be similar, but
it's okay. He tells them so well, it doesn't matter.
So here we go. And from all of us here at TARDIS Interruptus, we're out of here.
Cheers.
Have a good one.
Take care.
Bye.
But we are very, very, very excited this year for DragonCon's 25th anniversary to have not only a doctor, but an incredible one, and just a wonderful entertainer and all-around great guy, the 7th Doctor, Mr. Sylvester McCoy.
thought we could sort of bring everyone up to speed with what's going on. You are going to be doing rehearsal when you leave here for a play called The Mikado. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, yes, it's actually an operetta called The Mikado by Gilbert and Sullivan. Yeah. And not Gilbert O'Sullivan, but and he's no way related, but it's a Victorian opera, and it's very funny. And I play the Emperor of Japan. I also managed to get a homage to the spoons into it. I try to get the spoons into everything I do. I was kind of inspired by W.C. Fields. W.C. Fields, who, one great American actor, clown, comic, juggler. And he started off as a juggler and then eventually became a great comic and then a great film star. But he had it in his contract in every film that he had to have a juggling scene. So every film would work out a juggling scene. And then one day they came to him and they said, he agreed to play Mr. Micawber in David Copperfield. And they asked him, it was by Charles Dickens, and then he said, they gave him the script, and he looked at it and he said, where's the juggling scene? And then they said, well, obviously, Dickens didn't write the juggling scene. Well, he has now. It's in my contract. And so they had to do a juggling scene. And if you ever see that film, at the very end, for an inexplicable reason, there is Mr. Micawber juggling, and nobody knows why, but anyway. That inspired me. I thought, wow, that's a good thing. So since I heard about that, I've tried to get my spoons and everything. And I managed to get them into, I did a tour with King Lear around the world, the Royal Shakespeare Company, and which we also filmed. With Ian McKellen, you might have heard of him, I'm not sure. And I played the fool to his Lear, but I also played the spoons in the in King Lear. And how I got them in, I didn't say, can I play the spoons, or it's in my contract. What I did was, in rehearsals, I wandered around with this little case. The director, Sir Trevor Nunn, he was looking, and he said, so I said, what's in that case? And I went, and I opened it up, you see, like that. And I took out my spoons. And he went, oh my God, we have to have that in King Lear. So he made the decision, I didn't ask. And I've been carrying them around on the film set of
that movie
that must not be spoken about. Nothing's happened so far.
Speaking of future projects, we will not discuss details of that thing. But have you done any filming? Are you just doing rehearsals on that particular film, theoretically?
On the film that should not. Yes, I filmed. I was out there earlier this year for about 6 weeks. Did some filming then. I'm going up back in November and then back in February, I think, as well. So a lot of back and forth. I keep trying to fly around the world, over the timeline that way, because you lose a day every time you do it. So I keep going around, I'll get younger and younger.
And without giving too much details, you saw King Lear, I guess.
I did.
You saw Mr. McDonald there?
Oh, yeah. No, because we worked together, we're a couple of wizards. We're a couple of wizards.
Does the cast really join for that particular project?
Oh yeah, it's great. It's a great cast. It's extraordinary, really. Very exciting. And for me, the most exciting bit was working with Kate Blanchett. She's a stunning lady, great lady, wonderful, wonderful. Down to earth lady. And also, what's his name? Papa Hugo. Weaving. He's a smashing bloke. Really? The Australian actors are really down to earth. They don't have any size. They don't think they're stars, really. Although they are the biggest stars in the world, some of them. But, they were both terrific people to work with.
Hugo Weaving is sort of in his career over here, and like in films and things. Really nasty villain, but like apparently in real life he's like just the most charming man.
Oh, he is such a charming and great fun and a great laugh and has a wonderful sense of humor.
And what besides all of these theater things, you still have the new audios that you're doing, the Seventh Doctor is Living On with Audio Adventures, and you sort of instigated this, where you took the basic blueprints from what's been called the Cartmel Master Plan, or Andrew Cartmel's idea of where the show was going to go after that season that got truncated. And you're doing audio adventures with those. How's that coming along?
Well, we've done a few, and it's good fun, really. It's doing it. Sophie's had to, because you know, she's older, and so she's had to lighten her voice to go back to there. For me, it doesn't really matter, because I'm a time lord, I can do what I like. it's good, it's interesting, and it's quite interesting to see where it's going. What is also interesting is that because Doctor Who has carried on since then, and it's now got a history, but although that history is the future from where we're standing in these lost stories, we can't really go to where we were hoping to go, you know, really go to that place. Because originally the idea was, and it was a Cartmel and McCoy kind of discussion, we both kind of had long discussions about it, was that we would try and peel another layer off the onion of Doctor Who, and that we're going to try and create the fact that he was part of a triumvirate that had created Gallifrey, and that so you know, and therefore a new mystery would be would happen. So that's where we were going to go to, but we can't go there now in the audience because it doesn't in any way fit in with what's happened since. Yeah. I mean, we have to keep it within the timeline or the storyline in a way. But the companion would leave in that the season, so many seasons, and then the plan was that Sophie would leave, and I'd get a new companion. So that's in it. It was that area of it where this new companion has been tried out in it.
And do you like her?
Yeah, she's great, but she's a boxer. No, it's really frustrating. She's a real professional boxer, I think. She's really very, very good. I mean, she's beautiful. She's small, petite, but knock your head off. And what's really interesting, sad in a way, is that because it's an audio, you can't make use of that skill. Well, just think what it would be like in television, having someone, a companion who can actually go, a down like this goes, yeah! Or something like that. You know what I mean? She's got, I think she does maybe Thai kickboxing as well, all that kind of stuff. But how do you do that in audio? Ow!
From watching your early work and watching Doctor Who and seeing the last couple of days, it seems like the era of like golden age of you did Flinton, W.C. Fields, Laurel and Hardy, Groucho Marx.
Yeah.
Can you kind of speak to that? Are those your influences, or is that just something that I'm crazy about?
No, they were my influences. I mean, I didn't really. I became an actor when I was 27 by accident. I didn't know. Someone asked me to do the job, and I said yes, because that's what I always say. I would say yes, I can't say no. I haven't got any money on me, so don't ask. I don't hate to say it, I have to say no. Anyway, so I always say yes. And it was a good job I wasn't a woman, and you'd be in terrible trouble, really. But anyway, so I started acting with no training, and suddenly I discovered I had a whole pile of skills. Just they were there. I was carrying them around for 27 years, and I didn't really know I had them. And my skills were very much like Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, but there's Stan Laurel, all those silent comic people. I think I'd say, like, and so I actually did end up playing Stan Laurel and Buster Keaton, and I also played Ben Turpin, I don't know if you remember him. He'd cross eyes like that, and he'd have a moustache, and he'd say, I'm an expert, and I earn $1,000 a year, you know, or something. But in those days, that's a lot of money. And that's all we knew about it. We made a show about that. And so I could do all that stuff, just naturally, it was there. I often wondered why, when I was a child, my mother, we didn't have television, you know, in those days, but we had two cinemas in town, the La Scala de Noon and the Picture House, and they changed the films every 2 days. So you could go to one, and then you could do every day. And my mother was a widow, you know, I was killed on the war, so you know she was just alone, really, with me. And so I think she used to take me. I know she took me to the cinema as a little baby, and I grew up in the cinema. And I must have grown up watching, you know, those films as they were coming out, or, you know, and then just soaked it all in. And I've been, you know, suddenly bang, there it is. And so you know, lots of people always said to me when I was starting, like, you're just like Buster Keaton, you're just like Charlie Chaplin, you're just like that. And I better go look at these guys properly. Okay. I found out that I adored them.
Now, when you came and left in Doctor Who, it was very weird and bizarre. Can you kind of talk about the mood on the set of the series when you joined, when you moved for Tyler Ryan and took over the part, and then when you left, when you kind of knew maybe something was going on? What was the mood like, and how did you sort of keep everything going?
Well, when I started, I started from ignorance, because I hadn't seen Doctor for years. I'd watched it up until halfway through Tom Baker's tenure. And then I'd become an actor and stopped watching it because there were no VCRs, there was no way of recording it. And so I lost touch, and that was it. I was getting on with my life, and Doctor Who was getting on with his. And then when they asked me to do it, I just had this distant memory of it. Actually, Troughton was very strong in my mind, because he was my first Doctor. And so I kind of approached it that way, with ignorance, really. So, I don't know what the mood of the set was. I think people were very pleased that it'd come back, because it had been taken off after the Colin.
Yeah, that was such a stormy ending.
Yeah, it was a stormy ending. So people were pleased that it was back. And I remember we were filming outdoors in a part of London where they film a lot, but it's the it belongs to the Navy, the British Navy. It's their big, posh headquarters, very grand. And when we were filming there, there was people with hard hats on the roof, fixing the roof, and there were admirals hanging out the window, and everyone was cheering because Doctor Who was back. So yeah, it was amazing, kind of, how excited people were on the, not in, you know, on the set, but outside the set as well. They were just so excited Doctor Who was back. So it was kind of an optimistic start, really. It was great. And but then when it finished, we didn't know it was going to finish. We had no idea. The producer, John Nathan Turner, was told it was finishing, but he didn't tell us. And that a speech was written where, you know, Sophie and I walk into the distance talking about other planets and cups of tea and things like that. And that was put in just at the last minute, but we still didn't know that that was part of what they call a hiatus, what I hate. Anyway, so we didn't know it was going to finish. So still, we were very optimistic because it was the feedback was terrific. It was taking 3 years, but it was beginning to bubble and bubble and bubble, and we knew that we were onto the right track, and then they took it off.
And yeah, because your run was pretty incredible. You got the short film stick on, and it's that's part of the reason I'm so happy about that film, is because it's kind of like, you know, you can sort of tell them to piss off.
I don't think Radagast the Brown would say that.
Yeah. It'll be interesting.
So I'm supposed to talk about it. Don't ask me about the costume. No, I mean, Saruman the White, well, you know who he wears. Gandalf the Grey, you know who he wears.
So it's
like Radagast the Brown. I'm not telling you what he wears. That's a secret. Talk to him. Do I like the costume?
Of course.
course I do. I'm still good at the film.
He likes to check, too. You have a very interesting point of view on the Doctor Who film. When I talked to you about this last night, I was like, oh, we got to use that for today. So I think your work in the Doctor Who film, Paul McGann, is incredible, and it's tender, and it's nice. But it's also like, you know, there's a doctor who's listening to, you know, music, and he's... It was very nice. But you have a different point of view on your part in the Doctor Who movie and why, how these things could have been better. And I just thought it was interesting, and I want to share that.
Well, you see, yes, the thing is, it didn't really succeed, that film, because it was meant to be a pilot film, principally for an American audience. And although I believe 9 million people watched it, which, you know, considering you've got just 50 million, or you did have then, not even more, in the country, it's not very many. But then the other day I heard the news that Charlie Sheen, is that his name, who's just left 2.5 men or something. Whatever it is, he's left it. But they said, the new guy's coming in, you know, he's got a big job to try and make it work. But, because it's very successful, it was watched by 12 million people, and I thought, wait a minute, we were watched by 9, so that's not that bad, is it, for a first outing? But anyway, it was deemed not a success. And my theory is that I think the producer, God bless him, wanted to give everybody everything. He wanted to give the fans, who knew all about it, kind of as much of the, you know, the history, you know, the kind of the handing over, all that. And he wants to do the transformation scene and all that kind of stuff. He also, had to play to Fox Films, to whoever else was involved, the BBC, and there were all these bosses, too many cooks, and it was spoiling the broth, really. They shouldn't have had me in it. They should have done it with Paul, simply, because I established it with Paul, and then brought me in to explain, you know, what had happened, how we got there. Because I think it was confusing for an audience who knew nothing about Doctor Who, not an audience, but an audience that knew about Doctor Who, it was, you know, they knew what was going on. But for the majority of the audience they wanted to capture out there in America, they'd be thinking, oh, there's that guy, oh, he's having a cup of tea, oh, he's whispering, oh, he's Doctor Who, what about this? And then suddenly, you know, he gets shot by, you know, in San Francisco, and don't leave my heart. He leaves one of his hearts in San Francisco. Terrible. Anyway, and then suddenly Paul McGann arrives. You know, Jesus suddenly arrives. And so, you know, the Deep South, you know, the religious right, the Deep South thought, wow, I'm tuning into this. Jesus is up. I just thought it was confusing. It should be much more crisp and clear and, you know, clarification. So I think I should not have been in it. Although I enjoyed it immensely being in it, and I was rather proud of what the little bit I did and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I don't think I should have been in it, really. It's my fault.
So when you were filming Doctor Who, how aware of post-production were you in the process of filming, and how did you adapt to knowing that, like, they're going to put stuff in maybe when you were filming?
Sorry, what?
Post-production, you know,
Doctor Who? Something.
Yeah, when you were doing Doctor Who.
Post-production? I'll tell you this. When the new doctor came, I think it was David Tennant's doctor, suddenly the Daleks seemed to be flying, you know, kind of hovering up the stairs, going up the stairs.
Which you started?
Yeah, and then in Britain they were saying, oh, for the first time ever. And I was going, wait a minute, no, we did it first. But how we did it? This is post-production. This is how we did it. You imagine, that's a Dalek, right? And there was the stairs. I think I'm there. So that's the stairs. And that, now, there's a wall here. So they cut a hole in the wall and put a flap over it. And then they put two metal bars into the valley. And then there was a bar behind the wall. So there was a bar going up like that. Scaffolding going up like that. Scaffolding there. And so they got the Dalek, and then they got 10 men on the stairs. It's an action, and this Dalek is going up and down the stairs like this. Did you believe you got a lightweight Dalek? They used a heavyweight one. You know, by the time the Dalek got to the top, it was throwing up. It was it. That's overaction.
Two stories in particular. One, when we were filming Paradise Towers, it looks like you and Richard Briers were just having the best time ever making that episode.
Richard Briers is a funny, wonderful, warm person. He's a lovely man, and I will always make me laugh before I even met him. And so it's great to meet him. And we hit it off with the same sense of humour, and it was very difficult to act with him. Sometimes you couldn't look at him in the eye. Because you just go, so you know, there's a lot of acting, looking at people's heads, you look up here, you look down here, just, as soon as you make eye contact, you just, you know. So we had a, yeah, it was a hard time trying to make that one, really hard. But that doesn't mean
hard. So you're on the set, you're filming, and obviously you know you're going to have all kinds of villains and aliens and baddies that you're going to meet, and it's probably exciting to see what they come up with and things like that. What went through your mind the absolute first time you saw the candy bar?
I thought, oh, how sweet.
The candy bar.
Well, I love the idea in Doctor Who where they used to take teddy bears and make them frightening or take, you know, those toys that people children love and turn them into somewhat scary things. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and the result is last night's, you know, film, you know, in a way, that we watched. They're all those toys, you know, Terry's terrified of them. That's because he watched the only Doctor Who's with me. But anyway, when he came on, I thought he looked amazing. I mean, it looked an amazing costume, the guy, you know, absolutely. But the voice, they gave him the wrong voice. That was the problem, it was just the wrong voice. If they'd have revoiced it and gave him more of a fearful voice, frightening voice or whatever it was, that would have made it work, I think, much better.
I think that every Doctor gets these stories, I think, that like live on in like the overall legacy of the show long term. I think Remembrance of the Daleks is probably the one that they're gonna, it was sort of a game changer in how we looked at the Doctor, how we looked at the Daleks and everything. What was filming that like? Because it's some stuff work for that too. I think. And sort of, with that episode, what was it like with your Dalek story?
Well, yes, it was good. I didn't really feel, you know, sort of the real Doctor, so I would work with the Daleks, really. I thought, yes, now I am the Doctor. And there was lots of adventures on that particular story. When we were, because it was, one, it was about race. The story was about race, it was set way back in 1963, just before Doctor Who starts, as you know. I love that moment on the television set where Sophie's watching the telly and then she just and say, and now a new science program called Own, and she switches it off. And I thought that's such a wonderful tease. But, so we've gone back to that time, and you would see things on the window. No Irish, no dogs, no Irish, no blacks, you know, all that kind of stuff in renting rooms. So we had that in our one of the scenes. Now, the thing is, the director was a very middle-class man, and smashing blow, and a really good director, but a bit out of touch with, you know, what's happening on the streets, if you know what I mean. And he was going to cut that scene. And luckily, I wasn't in it, but luckily I was there. There was a scene with Sophie, and I said, no, you can't cut that scene. I mean, that scene is all about what this story is about. It's about race. It's about, you know, race hatred, race fear, and, you know, you've got to stop it. And that was part of our job, was to, you know, in an entertaining way, but at the same time, you know, kind of discuss these topics, because young people were watching, and we in Britain were going through that whole period of change, which now, especially in London, we are a great multicultural city, and it's brilliant. I mean, it's absolutely brilliant. The way it's happened in the early days, I used to think it would never happen, you know, because it was embedded, but it's not. So anyway, we were doing this racing, and he did eventually put that scene in where she turns, you know, the notice on the window and reads, "No colours, no blacks, and the dogs in the bank," and leaves. So within the Daleks, there are, you know, two coloured Daleks, you know, and they were backing each other, but that was not kind of focused on in that race way, but it was there, this vision. So it was also the 60th anniversary of the Easter Rebellion in Ireland, when the Irish rose up and started the rebellion against the British Empire. And it was Easter Monday, and Easter Monday was a very important day. That's when all the rebels were shot by the Brits after they lost that particular day, but they won the whole battle again. So they get shot. This is the anniversary, the 60th anniversary. The IRA were active in Britain anyway, blowing up things and doing all that stuff. So we were filming underneath Waterloo Station, one of the main stations, and it's under the tunnels underneath. And there was a great explosion, this explosion of a battle between the two Daleks. And I was watching, and suddenly smoke came out, and there was a huge bang, and car alarms went off, and some windows got smashed. Because this was the BBC Pyrotechnic Boys, and they'd be trying to kill me since I did not know what I was doing. And so there was this huge noise, and it was on the radio immediately. But the IRA had blown up Waterloo Station. The BBC had got permission, but someone had forgotten to tell the police. I think that we were letting off explosions on the 60th anniversary of the Irish Rebellion. So anyway, there was mayhem, and ambulances arrived, and fire engine, and police cars. And I was standing here. The street was there, and there were the smoke was coming up here. The first came an ambulance right down there, followed by a big fire engine. And then it screeched to a halt. And then the driver of the ambulance's face, his jaw just went. Because out of the smoke came three guns.
I think one of your probably more interesting than other kids' works was Greatest Showman Gallatin, which sort of took a little bit out of Dr. Who itself. But you got the guest list for that episode is pretty incredible. I mean, you had T.P. McCann, who was well-known, and then you got to work with Jessica Martin, who is an incredibly sort of improv actress as well. Can you talk about making that as well?
Well, that was great fun to do, because, I mean, Jessica and T.P. McKenna, and there was another wonderful woman actor, she's very old, she's gone now, sadly, with a deep voice. Oh, she can remember her name.
Peggy Mount.
Oh, she was just glorious. And and those who don't know, she was this old lady, but she spoke like that. Sorry, she was in all the great comic films of the generations, really. So she was in it as well, and as well as many others. But we made it in the deserts of Dorset. Now, those who don't know about the deserts of Dorset, there's a big sand pit in Dorset, South England, where it's huge. I mean, you're in the middle of it, and it looks like a desert. You can't see the end of it. And the television companies and film companies use it quite a lot. And we used it for survival. And then we also used it for this, because there was a lot of desert around. So it was hot. Again, it was incredibly hot. An interesting thing happened. Where we were filming was where the submarines, kind of coming, British Navy submarines. And T.P. McKenna and I were having something to eat. And we were in this restaurant, and I wasn't known then. I was still early days. And but T.P. was very well known. And we were sitting there in this restaurant, and these rowdy sailors came in. And they kind of saw T.P., and they started kind of going, oh, you know, being annoying, really. And, you know, T.P. was going, oh, just ignore them, let's get on with it. But they were just being annoying because he was famous and they just wanted to take the mickey out of him. And then suddenly I lost my temper and I stood up and said, now listen here. Why did you do it? Why did you come in here? Did he do anything to you? What's he done? He's having a quiet meal. Why are you giving him a hard time? What's he done to you? And they all got... And I was going, oh, God. And I wasn't showing. Anyway, so then I said, you know, I saw that there were submariners. I said, you're all submariners, aren't you? Yeah. Well, I said, my father was a submariner, and if he were here, he would be ashamed of you. And they went, no, he wasn't. Yeah, he is. Tell what you mean and all that. I said, yes, he was. In summer, he was on a submarine in the Second World War, and it was a Turkish submarine. It had been built by the British for the Turks. But when the war it started, they kept it, and, you know, and it's called 632, I think. That's its number. That's all his name was. I think I have a Turkish name, but no one could pronounce it. Anyway, they were going, no, you're just making it all up. But there was an older sailor with them, and he suddenly said, no. I remember now, reading about it, there was a Turk, he knew the history, and then those Turkish sons never got to Turkey, and he kept them to defend us. And so they suddenly went all sheepish, and then eventually they came over and joined us, and eventually we had a great night. But that was just it's a strange moment about fame and how people react to it sometimes. You know, they love it and they hate it at the same time. But we managed to get through that.
Was it rough for you growing up having a father who died in the war and having, obviously there's a distinction growing up with that, because you can say that, and it would sort of make people stop and think. But was it rough, particularly your mom mentioned different films and stuff, but how did you cope with that growing up, and what was your attitude towards that?
Well, I think I coped with it quite well, really. My family, my granny, my mother's family, the Sheridans, the battling Sheridans, I mean, they really were battling, they always fighting each other, but they were passionate Irish people full of, you know, love and anger at the same time. So they brought me up. But that was all right. No, I had a really... Dunoon was a very safe little town. You could go out at 8 o'clock in the morning and not come back till 7 or 8, you know, and nobody would be worried about you, you know, during non-holidays, non-school days. You were safe with anything. So it was a great place for a child to grow up. Not good for a teenager, but good for a child. But, I think a child who has a mum and dad has a right to the love from that parent. It's their right. They don't have to earn it in a way. I mean, I know this doesn't always happen, but nature dictates generally that that's what happens. You my mum and dad love me. Okay, I will. But if you're an orphan, you've not quite got that right, and you learn early on. So what you then do is you've got to make sure that you can earn it. So in a way, my performance, I was always performing. I was always, you know, kind of trying to make people smile, laugh, you know. And I know that comes from the fact. So that's how I cope with it. And I made people laugh and smile a lot, so I was pretty happy with that.
Now, we also are allowed some time for questions. So if you have a question for Mr. McCoy, raise your hand. And we are going to send someone out there to talk to you with your questions. So, here we go.
Oh, I said Mikado. I thought you were going to say, you said tomato, I said tomato.
Mikado. Let's call the whole thing off.
Oh, hello, is it coming over?
No,
I put it onto on. I switch it on.
Yes.
It should be off or off. It says on there AF. It's on AF. That's Scottish for off, isn't it? I should not see that. Anyway, I can't go. Bar. I go to bar. You have to say bar. It's a posh place. And in England, you say bar. They go wrong. Bar. Anyway, we say bar. Well, I say bar. But anyway, not bar, they say bar. So that's where I'm going to be doing it. So, anyone else? Others up there? Hello.
Oh, my God.
Survival, the one about cats on a planet somewhere, and it was incredibly hot on the deserts of Dorset, I just talked about. The BBC didn't give any shading for anybody, although I was all right, I had my umbrella, I wasn't going to share it with anybody except Sophie. Come here, Sophie. No. They were in the desert. There were these girls all dressed up in furs, you know, cat people, and really hot. And there was an island, you know, really uncomfortable heat. And of course, they were all made up. They had hair on their faces and all that kind of stuff, ears, cat ears, and whiskers, and all kitten caboodle, or the whole cat caboodle, actually. It was unbearable for them. They were, you know, wilting, and it was horrible. And one of them just couldn't stand it anymore. And I was completely freaked out. And she just ripped her costume off. And was last seen running over a sand dune. And I was found her over again. And the only thing is that she forgot she was only wearing a thong. So that's the one I like best.
When Charlie Chaplin made up the tramp character, he sort of took whatever was at hand, his own natural tendencies, and created this wonderful character. How much? What was the process of you creating your doubtful and spoken as magic?
All right. Yes. It kind of grew visually, really, because I tend to be kind of visual in my imagination. And when I went to meet the producer, for the interview about the job. He was interviewing lots of people, and I arrived, and it was summer in England. Well, it was one day. Anyway, I was wearing a straw hat, the way it ended up with Doctor Who. So I arrived with my straw hat on, and I meet Jonathan Turner, and we have this interview, and it goes on for hours and hours and hours. And then eventually he says to me, you know, I love that hat. It's got to be Doctor Who. And I say, well, if the hat's in Doctor Who, so am I. So it kind of started with that visual thing. But I love Chekhov plays, and to this day I've still never been in one. It breaks my heart. But I love Chekhov plays. I love that, and I love the costumes and that. So I wanted the Doctor to have a kind of a jacket. It was properly, you know, comfortable, and moved with him. But they ended up, the jacket they gave me was made differently. It was kind of, but it's okay, it worked. The pullover I didn't want at all. I had no desire to have that pullover. Because also I work in television a lot, and I know that we're in the studio, it gets very hot. And, you know, wearing a big, thick pullover like that is just not comfortable. But I had to have it, I think, because Jonathan Turner's granny knitted them, so, you know. And then the trousers, they just came, and the two-tone shoes. And that was the visual look. I had, as I was taking over from Colin Baker, in his last story, he had an umbrella. And so when this big, it was a big golfing umbrella. So that was somehow part of, you know, my story. There was an umbrella in it. And then we had that for a bit, then, you know, got really big. And then I suddenly thought, actually, I would really, I'd like to have an umbrella. I think I'd be a good prop. So I spoke to the props department, and we came up with the question mark umbrella. And that's how that arrived. It was my idea to get the question mark in. I wish I could get rid of these. But keep that. It seemed to me a more subtle way of having a question mark. So that's how the umbrella arrived. And then because I suddenly had this image, the shadow image of what I would look like Chaplin, you mentioned Chaplin. Now, you see that shape, the shadow of Chaplin, you know who it is. And I thought, well, I'd like to create my Doctor Who. So that if you see that shadow, you say, well, that's, you know, Doctor Who is the president. That was, so that would be it. It was a connection like that. And what I did it to begin with was a bit Chaplin-esque. But then I got away from that towards the end and turned it into a little monster.
Who is your favourite companion out of all the candidates?
Well. I have to pick Bonnie. I don't have to. I do. But not like, I guess it's not like it's very easy because I only have two companions, didn't I? Only have two companions? How can I get the other one? I didn't even work with that damn dog. The reason why they got rid of the dog is because the deputy, K9, he had to be on flat. He had to go on the flat. As the Daleks had to be on something flat. And in the early days, that was all right because it was all mostly done in studio. But once it got out into the outdoors, this old beanie became a big problem. So that's why I got rid of the dog. And also, I heard tales that, you know, when Tom Baker was running, because the dog was so slow, he had to do it in slow motion. The Daleks, because they had to be adapted for outdoors. And when I did the one in my story of the Daleks, they gave you know those balls, they have on wheelbarrows, you know, kind of orange balls, like a wheel. You have them over here. Yeah, it's like a Dyson thing as well. But anyway, they gave them three of those balls, you know, so that they thought they could get over the rough. But no, I mean, what happened was that every time they moved, the hooks just come out of the pub and they'd be drinking all that. You know, now the Daleks have three balls, so that's all right.
Would you ever think, or being involved with thinking of an anniversary coming up?
Well, I know nothing. Yeah. I know nothing. I'm hoping that the feedback I get from all over the world, from Who fans, is that they would love, you know, all the Doctors to be in it somehow. Yeah. I think that's the general. They would respond to that groundswell. I mean, I've heard rumours, but I've never heard anything directly from them, that something like that's going to happen. So I hope that does. I'd be very pleased, because I've always wanted to, when I was doing it, I wanted to do one with the other Doctors, and when I wasn't doing it, I wanted to in it and do it, because I knew that I loved it when I watched The Five Doctors, I also loved it when I looked at the photo shoot, you know, they did a photo shoot of The Five, was it The Five Doctors? Because Tom Baker wasn't really working in it, he didn't film it, they used old stuff that he'd never, kind of had before, somehow they couldn't complete that story, so they had that old stuff and they fitted him in. But I love the idea that when he kept having the photograph taken, he wouldn't even turn up for that. So they went to Madame Tussauds and got a plastic dummy. If you watch it, there's this kind of, you. I just love that, that's great. But hopefully. So keep on trucking, keep on discussing it on Facebook in your face or whatever it is.
Do you have a favorite improvised line or action from your running show?
I did do it a lot. Much to the frustration of the director. But it's such a long time ago, really. I'm sure if Sophie were here, she'd be able to tell you. I mean, she would know. So the great thing, when Sophie arrived at the beginning, I don't even, if you look at my jacket, Doctor Who, I've got these big pockets. The reason why I have them was I wanted to keep my script in them. I always like lying in my Linus blanket, something called, I needed the script. Even if I didn't, as long as I was there, I knew it was there. I didn't have to necessarily, but I did look at them, but I didn't necessarily have to. And if you look very carefully at the early shooting of the day, on the right pocket is big. And then as I did the scenes, I moved that scene. So if you look very carefully, at the end of the day, this pocket's out there, this one's empty. When Sophie first arrived, she knew all her lines. And she knew mine. She was brilliant. That's all right, what I say. Sophie, what do I say? She told me, bang, I said it, it was fine. But then after a few years of working with me, she was going into my pocket and trying to find the lines. But I'm sorry, maybe it'll come back to me when I'm wandering around, but I can't think about anything I said, really. Except I'm the doctor. Is that my mind? No, yes.
Ten favorite episodes, half of them are in your tenure. My question is about what are your memories of Battlefield?
Oh yes, Battlefield. Well, that was great because I was working with the glorious and lovely Brigadier. He's a wonderful man. Lovely bloke. And I got to know him before I worked with him on Doctor Who, going on cruises and going to conventions and stuff like that, and he was just such a smashing bloke. The word gentleman, I mean, that was invented for him. He wasn't gentle, kind, affable, lovely bloke. And he loved the fans as well. And he was greatly missed, but he was also terrific as the Brigadier, so that was good to work with him. But I remember, a memory I do also have of that is that we filmed it in the most beautiful part of England called Rutland. Now, Rutland, it was a county, and it's the smallest county. It's a very small county of Rutland. And it's got a great beer. Rutland beer. But we were filming by a great lake, if you remember, I never saw it. And this lake also fed into the water system, drinking water of Birmingham. So, big industrial city, not Birmingham, Alabama, it's a bit long. I don't want to get that over here yet. Anyway, so Sophie, as you might remember, goes into the water, comes and has to come up as if she's gone down. You know that backward filming and all that. So she's down there, and she's got to come up with a sword, or I can't remember. All that kind of stuff was going on. But before she went in, they had to give her special pills because the water was so dangerous. And I was thinking, wait a minute, this is what the people in Birmingham are drinking. No, they did. It was kind of vials, disease, or something like that. They had to give her pills, so that she wouldn't get ill. But so when you go to Birmingham, don't drink the water.
So that's the way of time for two more.
All right. Oh, I don't know. Can I get through here? Sorry.
Big way.
Hello.
Hi,
hello.
Who's your favourite doctor
and why? Who's my favourite doctor? Patrick Troughton was my favourite. He was the very first one I ever watched. And I think the first doctor you ever watch is the one that you really hold as a favourite, I think, generally. Who's your favourite? Apart from me.
The 11th.
Who's that? Yeah, he's great, isn't he?
I hate him.
No, I think he's great. I love him. I love him. When they said he was going to do it, I said, no, you can't give Doctor Who to a 12-year-old. But
he's turned out to be absolutely brilliant. And you look, by the way, absolutely lovely. I love your outfit. Isn't it great? Please pop. Are you bigger on the inside? Or you eat lots and lots of food? Anyway, yeah, the match is terrific. I really like it. People are pointing. Sorry, yes. Oh, there's a lady here knitting. Where's the gimmicky?
I'm a huge Big Finish fan, and I really love the Big Family. And without spoiling it for people who haven't heard it, you should all go listen to it because it's amazing. At the end, there was Ace of Hex and we sort of couldn't decide if the events that happened were actually, you know, put in place by the Doctor, if it would be that manipulative, or if it just was a coincidence. Do you think that it was the Doctor in all of that, or do you think that it was
you to try and guess and work it out. I think it'd be a shame to give it away. It's a bit like if I was starting to talk about the I think that I've been programmed by Wet Out Studios every time I say that. That happens. It's nothing to do with me. So I'm not going to answer that question, so there.
Today, so you can stop on saying hi. He has a panel tomorrow at 1 p.m., and we're excited to have that again. And please, please give a big round of applause to a world champion.
If you want to reach us here at Pod Culture Central, there are a few different ways.
You can email us, feedback@podculture.net.
Call our voicemail line, 812-672-4763. That is 812-672-4POD.
Comment on the website, podculture.com.
Let us know how we're doing and what you'd like to hear on the show. We'd love to hear from you.
Pod Culture.
Equal opportunity geekness.